think that that's the reason why it took so long to agree. And of course, it is a challenge to have 193 countries agreeing. But on the other hand, you know, and nobody is going to come out of this treaty. I mean, everybody's going to be happy that a conclusion has been reached, but everybody's going to be content of what is in the actual treaty. But of course, if somebody was 100% happy, that means that someone else would, another country or state will not be happy. So it really has been a compromise.
Well, we thank you so much for being with us. I know you must be absolutely exhausted having been at the UN all week and the vast, the major 40 hours of negotiations and the final push and then flying back to Geneva, Switzerland. So we particularly thank you. Minna Epps is marine biologist who participated at the UN negotiations on the High Seas Treaty, director of the Ocean Team at the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Next up, we talk about Tennessee and its banning of gender-affirming health care for young people, becoming the latest state to target the trans community. We'll talk to ACLU lawyer Chase Strangio. ACLU is challenging the laws. Stay with us.
Look at how they've washed your
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look now at the growing conservative attacks on transgender people and the LGBTQ plus community. At this weekend's CPAC meeting, that's the Conservative Political Action Conference, a number of speakers drew alarm with their transphobic comments, including former Trump advisor Sebastian Gorka, who warned Democrats who support trans rights are, quote, mutilating boys and girls. Right-wing Republican Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene vowed to reintroduce a bill called the Protect Children's Innocence Act that would make it a felony to provide gender-affirming health care for transgender youth. Another speaker was Daily Wire host Michael Knowles.
If transgenderism is false, as it is, if men really can't become women, as they cannot, then it's false for everybody, too. And if it's false, then we should not indulge it, especially since that indulgence requires taking away the rights and customs of so many people. If it is false, then for the good of society, and especially for the good of the poor people who have fallen prey to this confusion, transgenderism must be eradicated from public life entirely. The whole preposterous ideology at every level.
Michael Knowles' transphobic comments were widely condemned. Variety's Adam Vary wrote, "Pay attention, this is genocidal," unquote. This comes as at least 150 bills have been filed by Republican lawmakers across the United States that target transgender people and criminalize doctors who provide transition-related health care for trans youth. Just last week, several pieces of anti-trans legislation were signed into law. Tennessee, Thursday, became the latest state to enact a law banning gender-affirming health care for transgender youth. Alabama, Arkansas, Arizona, Mississippi, South Dakota, and Utah have also enacted bans on the life-saving treatment. The new Mississippi bill blocks public funding for clinics and institutions that offer this type of care. This comes as Nebraska State Senator Michaela Kavanaugh has vowed to bring the state legislature to a halt with a filibuster if lawmakers try to pass anti-trans bills.
collectively decides that legislating hate against children is our priority, then I am going to make it painful, painful for everyone. Because if you want to inflict pain upon our children, I am going to inflict pain upon this body. There's not a bill on this agenda, on any agenda coming forward, that will be spared. Every bill will go to cloture.
Meanwhile, Tennessee's Republican Governor Bill Lee has faced backlash after a high school photo of him dressed in drag went viral, after he said he would sign a bill criminalizing drag performances performed in public or in front of children. Nationwide, at least 14 bills have been introduced targeting drag shows. In Montana, the House endorsed a bill that, barring anyone under age 18 from attending drag shows, even after emotional testimony from one of the legislature's first openly transgender members, Representative Zoe Zephyr.
The bill purports to be about drag, and let me start by saying what drag is. Drag is art. Drag is beautiful. Drag is important to my community. My community and the rest of the LGBTQ community. There were comments about people who had gone 30 years ago to drag shows and saw adult-focused experiences. There's questions as to why are children coming to them now? Well, I'll tell you what happened. We lived through the AIDS epidemic. We lived through people trying to disallow our marriage. We adopted children. We grew up. And now we're taking some of our children and sharing an art form that's valuable to our community in a way that is age appropriate to them. That's why if you would have come to the drag show on Saturday, what you would have seen is people in full-length dresses, in beautiful gowns, celebrating our art, our history, and the fact that we're alive today.
For more on all of this, we're joined in New York by Chase Strangio, Deputy Director for Trans Justice with the ACLU LGBTQ and HIV Project. Chase, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about what happened in Tennessee and talk about what's happening across this country after that very powerful testimony.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. I mean, I've been coming on the show for the last 7 years to talk about this very issue. And I think taking a step back, what we have to acknowledge is how quickly this has escalated. In 2016, in the wake of marriage equality, we saw the first aggressive contemporary backlash against trans people in the form of the wave of anti-trans bathroom bills. And that rhetoric escalated to attacks on trans participation in sports, attacks on trans youth in schools, using the restroom, participating on sports teams. And how quickly have we gone from that rhetoric, which was understood to be false, including by proponents of it, to this current climate in which we are criminalizing trans adults going to the bathroom, where we are banning evidence-based medical care that is supported by every major medical association, where we are criminalizing gender expression and drag performance. And now we hear the rhetoric behind all of this, which at its core has always been about pushing trans people out of public life and eradicating transness. We see it so clearly. And if we look over the course of 7 years, this arc brings us to this moment where we are absolutely in crisis.
So talk specifically about Tennessee and Governor Bill Lee.
Yeah, so a few things have happened in Tennessee, and I will say Tennessee has often been a site of pushing anti-trans legislation. I've spent a lot of time there over the last 7 years testifying against bills and supporting the incredible community there. What happened over this last week was SB 1 and SB 3 were both signed into law. SB 1 is the law that categorically bans gender-affirming care for trans adolescents, which in essence will have the effect of shutting down some of the most robust and important sites of gender-affirming care in the South. And then we also have SB 3, which is the intended prohibition on drag performance. It is, in fact, a relatively narrow law. And if it is properly enforced, and I think there's a real question about whether that is anything that we could trust, that it is intended to ban drag performance. The governor signed both bills. He's come under fire for the hypocrisy because he himself has presented in drag. And then, of course, the reality is that these bills aren't about banning drag performance. They are not about banning expressions of gender nonconformity, as long as those expressions are seen as serving the status quo. What these bills are about is policing that which is seen as deviant and disruptive of the status quo, policing transness, policing communities coming together to support and celebrate their histories and legacies. They cannot be understood as separate from the many attempts to ban curriculum connections to historically accurate movements of resistance. This is a part of a national effort to cut off communities from their histories, whether those histories are histories of drag, whether those histories are histories of other resistance. We have to understand the bans on drag performance as central and connected to the bans on what we're seeing in the curriculum, what was categorized as so-called critical race theory. And in fact, these two movements, to ban drag and to ban so-called critical race theory, which is really just the banning of accurate history, came from the same sources. These are dynamic processes coming from the right. They're designed to control and regulate our bodies and our understanding of our lineages.
And the fact that Bill Lee himself is shown in drag?
I mean, I think the fact that there's so—I mean, look at Rudy Giuliani, look at President Trump. Drag is something that is wide-reaching in its experience in the world. Some of it is done in a way that's based in mockery. Some of it's done in a way that's based in celebration. There is no such thing as an easy and simple way to police gender nonconformity, except in a way that targets communities that are already under assault. I think it's very clear that in every instance of what we're seeing in state legislatures, we can identify the hypocrisy. We have lawmakers who consider themselves pro-life who are introducing bills that would punish abortion with the death penalty. We have individuals who are claiming that they are concerned about protecting children when the leading cause of death among children is death by firearms, and that they are focusing their energy on cutting off health care, removing children from loving homes, banning drag performance, and doing nothing to prevent the actual harms that are coming to our children at a time when, by the way, there is substantial evidence that our young people are facing significant mental health crisis across the country. And that crisis is not born of the fact of their transness. It is not born by the fact that they are connecting to their histories or they have more diverse experiences. We know that that's not the reality. The reality is that young people have more anxiety. They've been living in a pandemic. They have witnessed gun violence for the entirety of their lives. And we have real, real problems when it comes to what our young people need. And we are legislating in areas that are designed to eradicate populations, to harm young people. And the hypocrisy is staggering.
So I want to talk about the laws banning gender-affirming health care in Tennessee on Thursday. Also last week, the Kentucky House voted to ban access to gender-affirming medical care for youth. Let's turn to Democratic State Senator Karen Berg of Louisville, Kentucky, who lost her transgender son, Henry Berg Brousseau, to suicide in December at the age of 24. She condemned Kentucky's anti-trans bill and shared her son's last actions before he died.
The last thing he did at work before he went home and killed himself was to send out a press release warning us of what was coming, warning the world of this.
That was State Senator Karen Berg. Chase Strangio, take it from there. Talk about these particular bills.
Yeah, there's something so insidious about what's going on with these attacks on gender-affirming care, and it is manifesting in ways that is so harmful for our communities. I want to first just acknowledge that I knew Henry when he was a youth advocate in Tennessee. I saw him testify before his legislature at a time when they were pushing anti-trans bathroom bills. So there is a population of young people that has spent the entirety or a significant portion of their lives begging their governments not to target them, and the cost of that is significant. And right now, what we're seeing in state after state is something that 3 years ago I thought would have been unimaginable. We are having health care that is evidence-based, that is being recommended by doctors in consultation with parents for young people who are suffering and struggling. And this care works. And what we're seeing now is the legislature's intruding upon the decision-making of doctors, parents, and young people to take away the only evidence-based treatment that transgender people have when they are suffering and there are no other options. And in state after state, we're seeing these bills moved. And I must say that they are being fueled in part by a public discourse that has allowed there to be a legitimate debate over whether there are too many transgender people, over whether we have too much access to health care. And I urge people to take a step back and use information you already know about how health care works in this country. It is not easy to access. It is, in fact, incredibly difficult. And it is particularly difficult when it is stigmatized health care, that a population that faces so much stigma and discrimination needs. We are in a position now. I just got out of a 2-week trial in Arkansas over a very similar piece of legislation that we're now seeing in Tennessee and South Dakota and Utah and Mississippi and elsewhere. We had a 2-week trial. When tested, when the evidence goes before the court, there is absolutely no basis for these categorical bans. And we should be concerned for everyone if every time a group of lawmakers believes that it is a conspiracy for a group of people to thrive, that they start taking away our health care with nothing more than ideological opposition and unverified accounts of things that are simply not happening. We've seen it with abortion, and we're seeing it now with trans-affirming health care, and this is a crisis for our communities. Families are fleeing their states, but they don't know where to go. And I just want to say, too— Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
That we've heard a lot about, this is about children. This is about protecting children. First and foremost, these bills harm children. And second, as we've heard from the comments from CPAC and as we've seen from legislation targeting adults, this is not about targeting only children. This is about categorically attacking the trans community and all of us of all ages.
I wanted to ask you finally about the role of the media, and we just have about a minute. But over 200 New York Times contributors have published an open letter criticizing the Times' recent coverage of stories involving transgender, non-binary, gender non-conforming people, in particular concerning medical issues. The letter says Republican lawmakers have cited the Times' coverage to justify bans on gender-affirming care for youth. In response, the top editor of the New York Times has defended the paper's coverage of trans issues, warning journalists that such public criticism will, quote, not be tolerated, unquote. GLAAD has accused the New York Times of, quote, irresponsible bias coverage of transgender people going back more than a year. Chase, can you just summarize this debate?
Yeah, and it is not going back more than a year. This is going back more than 7 years by my count. And we have in the last 8 months, I think, 15,000 front page words over just the question of whether trans people are getting too much health care. There is an effort to identify a conspiracy of health care rather than understand the very powerful forces that are at play to try to attack and destabilize the material conditions of trans life. They are asking the wrong questions. They are asking questions that are infused with bias, that are informed by a global set of imperatives to attack not only trans people, but bodily autonomy and gender nonconformity more generally. And I think this coverage is abhorrent. And I think the idea that they will not tolerate criticism is quite a statement coming from the paper of record, when absolutely we need robust discussions. But there is a lot to look at in their coverage that shows that they are their entry point is one of bias, not one of fleshing out what is truly going on to the trans community right now in this country and around the world.
Chase Strangio, I want to thank you for being with us, Deputy Director for Trans Justice with the ACLU, LGBTQ and HIV Project. Next up, brand threat. That's what Fox executives have called Fox reporters and anchors questioning Trump's false election claims. We're going to speak to the president of Media Matters about this, the Dominion lawsuit, and much more. Stay with us. material by Sophie here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at Fox News and its handling of the 2020 election. In recent weeks, there have been a number of bombshell revelations about the inner workings of the network that have come to light as part of a $1.6 billion defamation lawsuit filed by Dominion Voting Systems against Fox. Rupert Murdoch, owner of Fox News, has admitted under oath that many hosts on his network endorsed Donald Trump's false claims about the 2020 election and that Trump's lawyers, like Rudy Giuliani, had used Fox to spread what he called really crazy stuff. Murdoch also admitted it was wrong for Fox to keep interviewing pro-Trump conspiracy theorist Mike Lindell, the CEO of MyPillow. But Murdoch suggested it was done for financial, not political reasons. Murdoch said it's not red or blue, it's green. In court filings, Dominion also revealed Murdoch had given Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, confidential information about Biden's campaign ads, along with debate strategy and possible violation of election laws. Meanwhile, the New York Times has revealed details of a major firestorm within Fox after the network projected on election night in 2020 that Joe Biden had beaten Donald Trump in the state of Arizona. While Fox made the accurate call, many executives regretted making the call because it hurt Fox's ratings among Trump supporters. At one meeting held November 15, 2020, Suzanne Scott, the chief executive of Fox News Media, told others, quote, listen, it's one of the sad realities. If we hadn't called Arizona, those 3 or 4 days following Election Day, our ratings would have been higher, she said. We're joined now by Angela Carusone. He is president of the watchdog group Media Matters, which recently sent a Federal Elections Commission complaint against Fox News based on evidence from the Dominion lawsuit. Angela, welcome to Democracy Now! Start off by talking about what your filing is about.
It's basically asking the FEC to investigate the claims that came out of the Dominion filings and then to take the appropriate action. It's completely within what the letter of the law says. The Campaigns Act is pretty explicit here. It says that you can't give anything of value to a political candidate that's not, you know, tracked, that's not locked. And in this case, in similar circumstances, it's found that these kinds of private information that could be used for political purposes is a thing of value. And so it seems to me black and white. And so what we wanted to make sure happened is that Fox doesn't, you know, sort of skate accountability because nobody went through and sort of nudged the FEC to take the action that it needed to take, which is to investigate and to just basically apply the law here.
So talk about what we know so far. I mean, people are leading very busy and stressed lives. It's hard to keep following up on this $1.6 billion lawsuit. Why don't you talk about the highlights of the remarkable email trail that has been released? What Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham knew at the time about the lies that were being told by Trump and his supporters, and the kind of pressure they brought on any reporter who dared to question because it was damaging the Fox brand.
Yeah, I think that to put it just sort of simply, they knew. They all knew. Rupert, all the way from Rupert Murdoch on down to the show producers, they knew what they were saying was not true, that it was actually a lie, and they did it anyway. And, you know, just to take a step back and say what this means in practice, well, Fox went from sort of calling some election results to accepting the election results to around that mid-November time period. In the following 2 weeks after that, they did more than 600 segments in just that last two-week period alone, specifically attacking the election results, promoting the Dominion conspiracies. And so in their coverage, what they really helped do was build the scaffolding for the big lie, which became the sort of fuel for the January 6th insurrection. So that's what it meant in practice. Behind the scenes, they really did know. And they didn't just know, they were deriding the conspiracy theories. They were attacking the promoters of it. And you sort of alluded to some of that in your intro, Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, who's one of the lawyers that was pushing it. They called her a lunatic on the same day that they had her on the show. On their shows, they were texting each other, admonishing the ridiculousness of this, but they did it anyway. They had it on the air anyway. And worse, Rupert Murdoch and Fox executives were penalizing other Fox personalities that were trying to either sort of soften the claims that Fox News was pushing about Dominion and about the broader sort of election, as well as punishing them. I mean, some of them were explicitly punished. So they said that your coverage is too hard, it's too aggressive, you need to change that immediately, almost in real time. I mean, before the show had aired, emails and messages were being sent from top executives to show producers telling on-air talent to get it together. So, I mean, they knew. And that's how I would put it simply, is that they knew and they did it anyway. And I feel like, you know, the trail of evidence here is so overwhelming that I think Fox is in some real legal trouble.
And talk about what you mean by saying it's an illegal corporate campaign contribution.
What you're not supposed to do is give anything of value. That's why we have to have, you know, all these FEC disclosures. When you give a political donation, it gets tracked, right? In this case, if you try to get around that disclosure law, that donation law, by giving something that is the equivalent of money that you would need to spend money on, or that could be considered something of value for a political campaign, you're either not supposed to do it or it's supposed to be disclosed. And it's pretty clear. So it is an illegal campaign contribution. And I think what's significant about this is not only that it's clear in this one instance that Fox News sort of, you know, broke the law, but the part that I think struck me about all of these complaints together and all these filings was that it seems so normal. Nothing about what they were saying to each other was considered extraordinary. So when, you know, when Rupert Murdoch takes an ad and runs away with it to give it to a political campaign, nobody inside Fox seemed to think that that was weird. There's no communication saying, hey, should we be doing that? Is that going to be a concern? When there were instructions to change coverage to help Republicans, I mean, Rupert Murdoch was literally sending messages like that. Nobody said, wow, that's weird. Should we be doing this? And I think my big takeaway is that I don't imagine this is the only instance of this. And that, in fact, it feels like what we're seeing here is sort of a keyhole view to how Fox News treats every single other major issue and story. And that means they operate more like a partisan operation than a news network. And I think there's probably a lot more complaints that could be filed as these things start to unfold.
Angelo, in light of all this, can you talk about the Republican House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, giving exclusive access to all of the January 6 footage from, you know, the closed circuit TV footage all over the Capitol and beyond to Tucker Carlson of Fox?
And I think that what it's two things, how we got there and what it means. How we got there is it's a reflection of the fact that the right-wing media with Fox as its crown jewel and the Republican Party are really fused together. They're not really two distinct entities that are operating in parallel. They really are one part of one big political, you know, conglomeration. And so this was actually a major concession that McCarthy had to make during his speaker fight. Is one of the things that some of the far right Republicans who were echoing calls from the right wing media were demanding, and he conceded to that. So the reason that it even happened is that the right wing media pushed a few of their big sort of Republican leaders to then make this an issue during the speaker fight. He conceded. So that's how we got here, is that it was sort of a creature of the right wing media.
And we have 30 seconds.
What it means is that it's an official rewrite. It's an official rewrite of what happened on January 6th, and they're using Tucker Carlson as sort of the chief storyteller of that new version of what took place there. And I think we all know what it's going to be. It's going to be lies and conspiracies that it was a false flag pushed by the Democrats and the news media.
And the fact that this is the people's footage, I mean, this is the footage of the Capitol being handed to this private corporation?
Yeah, and it's not being done in a transparent way. It feels much more transactional to me than transparent.
Well, Angela Carasone, we want to thank you so much for being with us. President of Media Matters, which recently sent a Federal Elections Commission complaint against Fox News based on evidence from the Dominion $1.6 billion lawsuit. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astu, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman.